We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're joined by James Rosen. He is the author of Scalia, Rise to Greatness, 1936 to 1986. James, welcome to the show.
Emily, it's great to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Now, you have dug into all kinds of history, especially in the last century in your writing. Why Scalia and why stop at 1986?
Well, so I knew Justice Scalia a little bit. One of the first things I did when I got to Washington as a new Washington correspondent back in 1999 was to write to Justice Scalia seeking an interview. And this commenced between us an unusual and at times often amusing correspondence that stretched over about 2 years' time. And we also had a pair of one-on-one lunches, just the two of us drinking wine, the justice making me eat off of his plate. I said, "Mr. Justice, I couldn't." He said, "Come on, come on, come on." So there I am shoveling vegetables off of Justice Scalia's plate into my mouth. And he drove me back to my office in his car. I've since confirmed, Emily, with classmates of his who used to drive with him on debate tournaments in the 1950s all the way through Clerks in the 21st century, that it was a scary experience for them as well to be a passenger in his vehicle. When I mentioned that I had been a passenger in Justice Scalia's vehicle, one of his clerks said to me, "God help you." And so he was so generous to me over a quarter century ago when I was a young reporter, and I was so fascinated with him since high school onward that I resolved that one day I would write about him. The substantive discussions we had at those lunches will remain as they were off the record. But in volume two, which will cover the Supreme Court years, I will excerpt from those letters back and forth. Why the first 50 years? So this book, Scalia, Rise to Greatness, 1936 to 1986, just out, tells the story of the first 50 years of Scalia's life. It ends with him being sworn in as a justice on the Supreme Court. And he had such a fascinating and consequential career, both in academia and high-level government service during the Nixon-Ford administrations. And the two existing biographies, Emily, that are out there already, both of them came out while Scalia was alive. He cooperated with one extensively, the other not at all. And both turned out in the same place, pretty much in open contempt for Justice Scalia's philosophy, his jurisprudence, his legacy, his conduct. So this is really the first comprehensive account of his life. This is the first to be published since his death. It makes use of a vast wealth of new documentary and personal sources that were either unavailable to or overlooked by the previous biographers. And I call it the first accurate account of Antonin Scalia because it's the first admiring account of this profoundly important man.
You use the word overlook just now, and that's a very interesting word to use in the case of Antonin Scalia. I want to ask not just what previous biographers, the two you've mentioned in particular, may have overlooked, but what the sort of broader public overlooks in reflection on the life of somebody like Antonin Scalia.
What people need to know about Antonin Scalia is that he was one of the most important American figures, not just a jurist or a Supreme Court justice. Antonin Scalia was one of the most important Americans of the last 100 years. That's because his philosophy of how judges are supposed to go about doing their business, which is interpreting the Constitution and statutes enacted since then and telling us what they mean, his revolution, Scalia's revolution in how judges go about that business, was so profound that it touches every area of American life, whether it's criminal law and you're accused of doing something and you want the right to confront your accuser. Thanks to Scalia's jurisprudence on the Supreme Court, a screen cannot be placed between the person alleging the crime and the accused defendant of the crime. They have to confront means confront, he said. That's just one example. First Amendment law, all over the law, whether it's civil or criminal or any of the areas of the law, Scalia's approach to how judges go about doing their business, he changed the way judges, lawyers, scholars all think about this. And it's much more common now than when Scalia began to adhere to the original meaning of a constitutional provision or its statute and to use the text, what he called textualism, to divine that original meaning. And no less a figure than Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan, who of course was appointed by Barack Obama, pronounced before Scalia died, that as a result of his influence on the way judges go about their business, we are all originalists now. It's the ultimate tribute from her.
Mm, that's lovely. I want to ask also about those really early years. Scalia's childhood comes at an incredibly pivotal time, not just for the United States, not just for the West, but for the world. How does that moment in history start to shape him as a man?
Scalia was born in New Jersey in 1936. He moved when he was five to Queens, New York, where he felt much greater affinity with the place. The defining event for Scalia, the historical context in which we would place his youth, would probably be the immigrant experience. His father came from Italy in 1920 with only $400 in his pocket and not speaking a word of English. And yet his father, Salvador Scalia, had made himself into a renowned Romance languages professor. Spent 30 years at Brooklyn College teaching Romance languages, and there became very suspect of translators and interpreters who would distort an original text through translation. And then Scalia's mother was herself the daughter of Italian immigrants, and she became a school teacher and also venerated the classics and composition and precision, and they were devout Catholics. And so from those three influences, the foundational sacred text and liturgy of the Catholic Church, his father's work in language and in translation, and his wariness of monkeying with the original text of something, and his mother's influences, Scalia emerged with a profound reverence for text, for the inviolability of original meaning of text. He tells the story at his Jesuit high school, which was also a military academy, Xavier, where he was valedictorian, that they were learning Hamlet one day, and a smart aleck in the class, not Scalia, someone else, said something, made a wisecrack to the Jesuit teacher, Father Tom Matthews, who was a fearsome character with an Irish brogue. And Scalia never forgot what happened next. He called it the Shakespeare principle and spoke of it for the rest of his life. Father Matthews glared down at the wise guy and said, "Son, when you're reading Shakespeare, Shakespeare's not on trial. You are." And it was, again, it contributed to this sense in Scalia that certain texts were inviolable. And he carried this forth, obviously, into his work as a judge and a justice on the Supreme Court.
That is absolutely fascinating. The translation narrative. That's absolutely fascinating, James. How much of this did you pick up on as somebody who was a personal acquaintance, a personal friend of the justice over the years at lunches and in other conversations and correspondence? And were you then surprised as you began the work of this biography and talked to folks? Did you learn, I guess, any new dimensions that you hadn't seen as a personal acquaintance of the justice?
So one of the few mysteries about Antonin Scalia's life that remained when I set to work on this book 5 years ago was how early in his life the ambition to become a Supreme Court justice began to burn within him. The justice's most ardent defenders, his family members, his law clerks, others, have always been leery of attributing this ambition to Justice Scalia too early in life, because they feel that to do so might somehow contribute to a false narrative about his life that was promulgated in the other two biographies that I mentioned earlier, which I call the careerist narrative. At every point in Scalia's career, whether he's assistant attorney general providing legal opinions in the Ford administration that preserve the powers of the presidency, whether he's a judge on the Court of Appeals issuing rulings that would be reviewed by the Reagan administration, his critics always asserted that Scalia was essentially working his way toward a Supreme Court nomination by currying favor with more powerful people, by tailoring his opinions to get ahead, which I call the careerist narrative. And of course, I interviewed so many people, Emily, who worked with him at different points in his career, all of whom used a barnyard epithet for that characterization. Scalia often rendered opinions that he knew would be unpopular, and he really didn't care what anyone said about him. He held to his guns if he believed that the law required it. This mystery of when he first began harboring the ambition to serve on the court was solved definitively in my research, and I tell this story in the book, Scalia Rise to Greatness. I interviewed someone who was one of the last three known survivors of Scalia's graduating class at Xavier High School, where Scalia was the valedictorian in that Jesuit academy. His name was Father Robert Connor. I just got an email from him a short while ago today. He's in his mid-80s. He is absolutely sharp of mind and logic and memory. He's still actively preaching and blogging, and he is an Opus Dei priest. And he graduated from Xavier with his friend Nino Scalia back when he was just Bob Connor, and they played marching band together. They played hoops together. Scalia set him up on a date once. They knew each other well. Come the summer of 1959, and this story has never been told anywhere else, I asked Father Connor, who, but for an interregnum, had a friendship with Justice Scalia that lasted until Justice Scalia's death, if he'd ever been interviewed by anybody else ever before about his relationship with Justice Scalia. He said no. I asked, what about the FBI? He said no. I think I'd remember that, because Scalia was subjected to 4 FBI background checks as he rose to greatness within 14 years. And I am the first researcher to really make use of those FBI files. So Father Connor had never been interviewed before, and he had never told this story before. But in the summer of 1959, when Scalia was 22 years old, and they hadn't seen each other for a little bit, Connor was with his parents in the Connor family home on Downey Road, the south side of the street in Queens. And they were having a terrible row because Connor had decided to quit med school and to go study Opus Dei in Rome. And Mrs. Connor was distraught because she thought her son was throwing his life away. So she summoned to the home in Queens, 2 men whom she thought could possibly talk sense into her son. One was a Jesuit priest named Father Morrison, who did come. The other was Nino Scalia. And as Father Connor recounts this scene to me, he's sitting in his brother's bedroom in the Connor home on the second story, south side of the street, Downey Road, Queens. And in walks Nino Scalia. Scalia was well known to this family. Scalia had been on TV quiz shows and student programs on the radio and television in the 50s, no videos or tapes of which survive, unfortunately. But Connor told me that his father would watch Scalia on TV, and if he hadn't seen it, his father would say to him, "Oh, you missed it. Scalia really gave it to him this week." The man that had fans as a teenager. In any case, he walks into Connor's brother's room and sees his buddy Bob and says to him, "What are you doing?" And Bob Connor says, "I'm going to go study Opus Dei." I said, as devout as he was, did Scalia seem to know what Opus Dei was? He said, "Well, I had to explain it to him that we find the sanctity in everyday life." And Scalia nodded and said, "Sounds pretty good to me." And this part has never been told before. It's in Scalia Rise to Greatness. Connor says to Scalia, to Nino, "Well, what are you doing?" And he says, "I'm going to go to the Supreme Court." And he says, "How are you going to do that?" And he said, "James," he had a job lined up with a law firm in Ohio somewhere. And I said, "Jones Day." He said, "Yes, that was it." And indeed, Scalia's first 6 years out of law school were spent practicing law at Jones Day in Cleveland, which then as now had a Washington office. He said to me, "This firm has a Washington office. I will be sent to Washington and I will rise." And I said, "Father Connor, did it sound comical or fanciful when he said that?" He said, "Oh, no, Nino was driven." I said, did it sound like it was a divine calling for him?" And he said, "I bet." And the way Father Connor put it was a convergence of 2 transcendent moments, almost a shared epiphany, where one says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I'm going to religion." And the other says, "What are you doing?" "I'm going to the Supreme Court and I will rise." And it really, to my mind, definitively solves this mystery of when this ambition began to burn within Antonin Scalia. And Emily, some folks are just blessed and gifted to know what they want to do with their lives from a very young age. Another example would be Charles Schulz, the creator of Peanuts, who knew from the age of 5 that he wanted to be a cartoonist. Antonin Scalia had an idea of what the Supreme Court was and why he belonged there. And everybody, every American, not least the Scalias themselves and the justices' other ardent defenders, are all better off that he did.
The Watchdog on Wall Street podcast with Chris Markowski. Every day, Chris helps unpack the connection between politics and the economy and how it affects your wallet. Fix the problem, not the blame. With threats of persecution of political figures, how should you react? Is this a political sideshow? It just demonstrates that we're an unserious nation. Should Trump own up to his mistakes? Should we ignore the Manhattan investigation? Whether it's happening in D.C. or down on Wall Street, it's affecting you financially. Be informed. Check out the Watchdog on Wall Street podcast with Chris Markowski on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast.
You know, I just recently finished, too late, the Christopher Caldwell book, Age of Entitlement. And I wonder how that era, as Scalia is aging into his professional career, and the civil rights movement is really changing the way we see the Supreme Court, is really changing the way we see the Constitution affected and maybe shaped the mind of Antonin Scalia, especially because the rise of his career also kind of coincides with the rise of the conservative movement, the Goldwater era, which turns into the Reagan era. How mm-hmm. does this sort of shape the way he sees the United States and its trajectory?
Again, I think the dominant prism through which he viewed his own times was first through his Catholic faith, then through the experience of his father. When Scalia was a professor at the University of Chicago Law School in the late 1970s and early 80s, just before President Reagan places him on the appellate bench and then on the Supreme Court, Scalia published a law review essay that was unlike any other in the history of law review. It was called "The Disease as Cure." And it was a wicked argument against affirmative action, naming names. The subtitle of the article was, which was very unusual, was a quote, the full quote: "In order to move beyond race, we must first take account of race," which was a line by Justice Harry Blackmun from his affirmative action decision in the Bakke case from 1978. And this piece, this essay, "The Disease as Cure," essentially made the argument that that affirmative action is reverse racism. It is the employment of the disease, race consciousness, as the cure for it. And it was at a certain point he delves into Swiftian satire and establishes a kind of handicapping point system that will be assigned to different ethnic pluralities based on how much they oppressed the African-American community throughout the centuries. And of course, he eventually abandons that because it's preposterous, the idea that let's say the Irish would have such and such debt owed to African-Americans or the Germans this much. And he eventually abandons that in the essay. But the most powerful part of it is he says, "My father arrived here in 1920 with $400 in his pocket and not knowing English. And he made of himself a romance languages professor." And he said, "Not only had he never profited from the sweat of a black man, I doubt he had ever laid eyes on a black man." And Scalia declared, I'm paraphrasing, but pretty closely, in this law review essay, "The Disease as Cure," published in 1979. And you can read about it in Scalia Rise to Greatness. He said, "The notion that I owe any man anything because of the blood that flows through my veins," he said, "was profoundly wrong." And it really, that essay marks one of the toughest, bravest attacks on the practice of affirmative action in the 1970s, when there were very few academics willing to stand up and say such things. So when you ask what shaped him, I believe it was his Catholicism and the experience of his father, which he would note not only in that law review essay, but which would shape his jurisprudence going forward.
I was very eager to ask you about the FBI inquiries that you brought up, James. Can you tell us more about these four background checks that Scalia undergoes in this time period?
So I'm very proud of Scalia Rise to Greatness for the sheer wealth of new documentary material it brings that has never appeared anyplace else before. There are a number of different sets of these materials. One is a secret oral history of his life that Scalia conducted in his Supreme Court chambers in 1992 with a woman attorney whom he had known for many years, looking back on his entire life. It wasn't unsealed, this secret Scalia oral history, until 2018. So this is the first biography to make use of it. There's what I call the RBG Nino letters or papers, which is the series of handwritten notes and letters and correspondence and memos and draft opinions that are flying back and forth between the chambers of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Antonin Scalia, not from the Supreme Court, but from where they first actually met each other, which was the appellate court, the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, where they served alongside each other and alongside Robert Bork and Ken Starr and others. And I got these papers out of the Library of Congress, and they show Scalia and Ginsburg going at it over fine points of the First Amendment with their characteristic legal genius and wit. But it also captures the birth and the blossoming of that famous friendship in real time. And then still another set of papers is what you asked about, the FBI papers. These were first declassified after Scalia's death in 2016. It's the first biography to make use of them. You see hundreds and hundreds of pages generated as four times within 14 years as Scalia rose through the executive and judicial branches. The vast machinery of the world's preeminent law enforcement organization was cranked up agents fanned across the country to interview everyone Scalia had known since the age of 13 in 1949 and onward. You see over the course of the four background checks, the increasing computerization of the process with reference to data banks being checked and so forth. And in these hundreds and hundreds of pages, as I say in the book, Emily, would that every life paid such close scrutiny would reward with such superlative testimonials. Because for hundreds of pages, the FBI agents heard only that Antonin Scalia was the smartest person they ever met, the most honest and incorruptible person they ever met, not only qualified to be a federal judge, but the most qualified person they could imagine to be a federal judge. In short, in none of these four background checks was any derogatory information about Antonin Scalia unearthed, for the simple reason that none existed.
Mm. And, you know, the other thing I was wondering in the book, if you could talk to us more about, is the both relationship and rivalry, might be a good way to put it, between Scalia and Robert Bork. Mm. Can you tell us more about this? I'll just keep it general and say this relationship, James.
Well, I'm pleased to say that just the other day on Facebook, Robert Bork Jr., posted that he has read the book and that his father is a major character in it and that he himself learned things about his father's relationship with Nino Scalia and
oh, wow.
congratulated me on the project. And it meant a lot to me. I interviewed Bob Jr. I also interviewed Mary Ellen Bork, who was Judge Bork's wife starting around 1982 until his death in 2012. She gave me permission to use a photograph from the Bork's wedding album where Scalia was a groomsman, and that appears in the photograph section of the book for the first time anywhere. I like to say that this book, Scalia Rise to Greatness, has the most sensitive and humanistic portrait of Robert Bork that's yet in print anywhere. He really awaits a first-class biography of his own. But back in the early 1970s, Robert Bork was the conservative star of the nascent, burgeoning legal conservative movement. He was a lonely figure in taking on the Warren Court for its excesses, for its departures from originalist intent, which was the phrase that Bork preferred to Scalia, whose elaboration on it was original meaning. But they were friends, and they and at various points, Scalia got a hand up from Bob Bork, including Bork allowing Scalia, when they both worked at the Justice Department, to make his one appearance that he ever made as an advocate before the Supreme Court in 1976, arguing before Chief Justice Warren Burger and the other justices, including Rehnquist, in a case in which Scalia's side won. But Bork was at AEI when Scalia got to AEI. Bork was at Justice when Scalia got to Justice. And they were really close friends, particularly when Judge Bork's first wife was alive, that the families hung out together. And Gene Scalia, the justice's oldest son, prominent attorney in his own right, former cabinet official, told me that one time after a party at the Scalia's house and everyone had left, his father turned on him and said, "That's why you study and you work hard in school, so you can have friends like Bob Bork." But a rift ultimately developed when Bork and Scalia were serving on the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit together over First Amendment law. Bork wrote an opinion about in a libel case, finding there was no libel by the celebrated syndicated columnist Sevens and Novak of the era. But in his opinion, Bork said that there should be a certain amount of evolutionary content in the way judges apply libel law, that this should happen even if it brings an element of judicial subjectivity into the considerations of the judge. To Scalia, this was heresy. He couldn't believe what his friend was writing. It was exactly the kind of imperial judiciary type stuff about the evolution of the meaning of statutes and so on that Scalia and Bork had spent 15 years inveighing against. And Scalia wrote a very sharply worded concurrence taking direct aim at Bork. This was called Ullman v. Evans and Novak. And I've got the behind-the-scenes memos, the draft memos, going back and forth between the chambers and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, sort of behind Scalia's back, writing to Bork and saying, "Here's how we have to address Nino's challenge," while she's still sort of engaging him on the law in their memos. It's fascinating stuff, but it did open up a rift. And by the time Scalia was on the court, and even after his dear friend Bob Bork underwent that terrible, bitter partisan rejection at the hands of the Senate the year after Scalia ascended to the court, Bork published a book in 1989 in which he hearkened back to the Ullman versus Evans and Novak case of 1984. And he didn't name Scalia, but he basically pointed to Scalia's concurrence that had stung Bork so deeply. And he said, in essence, that anyone who espoused the views that were espoused in that concurrence would have no business being a judge or even aspire to be a law professor. And it showed that that rift really remained, in a sense. And what's interesting, finally, about this, Emily, is that just as that crack in the bond with Judge Bork developed, then first began to blossom Scalia's friendship with Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
You know, a lot of the, I guess, treatment of that relationship with Ruth Bader Ginsburg is focused on Ginsburg and sort of how charitable of her, how magnanimous of her it was to befriend someone as crusty as crusty and reactionary as Antonin Scalia. But so little of it is from his vantage point, you know, somebody who is definitely has some very similar experiences to him, but also some very different perspectives to him. Does he think twice about this relationship, or as with, I think, many conservatives who come from this era, it's sort of natural to want to engage in good faith friendship and collegiality with people like RBG?
I think you're absolutely right that a lot of the commentary on Ginsburg-Scalia, and after all, this is a relationship that's so famous and so celebrated so widely now that it is enshrined in stage plays and opera. And, you know, just any day of the week, if you look online, you'll see references to it. I recently found two self-help podcast people saying, try and find the Ginsburg for your inner Scalia. But you asked about his perspective on it. I would agree with you that the commentary has at times taken on a kind of zoological tone. The idea that how remarkable it was that this hairy, forearmed conservative beast could somehow, across the divide, forge a friendship with this delicate porcelain liberal creature. The fact is that Scalia, and I'll cover this more in Volume 2 on his Supreme Court years, generally speaking, got along better with the liberals on the court than he did with the so-called conservatives. He felt that the liberals always behave more or less as they should and should be expected to behave. But his conservative colleagues on the Supreme Court often disappointed him by not adhering to his originalist approach and by appearing to his eye, in essence, to be sort of placing their finger in the wind and wondering what the New York Times was going to say about them, with the exception of Clarence Thomas, for whom he had a real reverence and a very close relationship. In these RBG Nino papers that I've described, which are first published for the first time here in Scalia Rise to Greatness, you'll see Ruth Bader Ginsburg from the very beginning taking an almost maternal approach to her new colleague on the Court of Appeals, Nino Scalia, repeatedly and needlessly expressing concern that his workload may be too heavy for him, offering to trade cases with him and so forth. You see her cajoling him, flattering him, pressuring him, quelling over him. For his part, you see Scalia heaping praise upon the drafts that he receives from Ruth Bader Ginsburg that was so superlative it was probably unknown to his brightest students or clerks and possibly even to his children. I concur. It's just perfect. Couldn't suggest any amendments, Scalia would write. And he would let himself, his hair down a little bit. He could acknowledge error in one memo to Ruth Bader Ginsburg that we publish. In another, he apologizes for producing an opinion late and saying, sloth that I am. And when she would say, Nino, if you would just change this or that piece of language, we could be unanimous. And he would scribble back on her memo and send it back to her chambers saying, let's be unanimous, AS. And so, again, you really capture both perspectives on this famous friendship, and you really capture its birth and its blossoming.
Now, Justice Scalia had some pretty spectacular appearances before Congress over the years, pipe in hand, really old school stuff, James.
Yes.
Reflecting on some of those moments, is there anything, I mean, they feel like such a different time, even though relative to the scope of American history, there really aren't. It really wasn't that long ago. But are there any takeaways, having just looked back at this first 50 years of Justice Scalia's life, you think that people can get if they plug in to YouTube some of those appearances that Justice Scalia made before at Congress?
So many of his appearances before Congress occurred in the early and mid 1970s, when Scalia held different positions in the federal government, particularly when he was the assistant attorney general for the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice. It's a very unwieldy title. It basically means the president's lawyer's lawyer. Scalia was responsible in that job for producing binding legal opinions when anyone in the executive branch, from the president on down, would ask for one to tell them whether or not some proposed initiative or program or policy was legal or not legal. It's the same job that William Rehnquist had held when he was nominated to the Supreme Court by President Nixon in 1971. And again, I've dived into the documentary record of Scalia's time as Assistant Attorney General. It was the post-Watergate era. It was a time when reckless and greedy ideas were flying in every direction, where Democratic lawmakers and the liberal news media of the time were bent on emasculating the presidency after Watergate. Scalia and the other conscientious conservative lawyers of that time held no real affinity for the lost cause of Richard Nixon, but they recognized that after Watergate and its subsidiary scandals faded from view, the country would still need a strong executive. And Scalia and others of that time, such as Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld, from their different perspectives, worked hard to preserve the powers of the presidency against this onslaught from the legislative and from the news media. And Scalia often did that in the form either of legal opinions drafted behind the scenes, and we have some previously unpublished ones from that time in the book, but also in front of the cameras testifying before Congress, before Democratic-controlled House and Senate hearings. There's a lot of talk today about the Church Committee because of the new weaponization committee. The Church Committee and the Pike Committee were the two select committees of the 1970s that reformed to start placing oversight on the intelligence community after Watergate. Scalia testified before the Pike Committee. It got to the point where this kid from Queens couldn't believe that he himself was standing astride the entire U.S. intelligence apparatus, because for a while it was decided that all covert operations should be run past the Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel to determine whether they were lawful or not. And on the afternoon of April 30, 1975, and this has never been told anywhere else, the White House called Scalia and said, "We need an opinion from you within a few hours' time as to whether it is lawful under the War Powers Act for the United States to land helicopters on the embassy of the U.S., the rooftop of the U.S. embassy in Saigon, to evacuate our personnel." And Scalia gave the opinion that it is lawful, but he said to himself, and he said later, and this appears in Scalia Rise to Greatness for the first time, "What if I hadn't given my approval? Would they have called off the operation with the helicopters and the embassy in Saigon on advice of counsel?" And he said, "What is this world coming to?" Unfortunately, most of those appearances, all of those appearances that he made as Assistant Attorney General before those congressional committees, were not videotaped, unfortunately, so they won't be found on YouTube. But you can, on C-SPAN, find Scalia's Senate confirmation hearing from 1986, when he was confirmed to be a Supreme Court justice, and where you can see him doing battle with the likes of Ted Kennedy and then Democratic ranking member Joe Biden. And this book has a lengthy section where we dissect Joe Biden's participation in the Scalia process. And frankly, the president, then Senator Biden, didn't distinguish himself. At one point, he said to the nominee during the hearings, "Forget about the Constitution. Let's talk politics," which, of course, is counsel that no nominee to a Supreme Court justiceship is going to follow.
You know, writing this book in the Biden era, I have to ask, James, with the benefit of hindsight, if anything about then Senator Biden's performance during those confirmation hearings. You know, for instance, I think when Michael Pack made the Clarence Thomas documentary Created Equal, they found some very relevant, obviously, going through the Anita Hill process, they found some very relevant old moments from Joe Biden's career. But looking back at his relationship or his performance during the Scalia confirmation, is there anything that just absolutely jumped out at you that was vintage Biden or maybe surprising about Biden in some respects?
Well, one was what I just mentioned, the idea that a senator engaged in a confirmation hearing for a Supreme Court justice would advise the witness, the nominee before the committee, to forget about the Constitution and just talk politics. That's not something you see too often. There was points in which, in the questioning, Senator Biden had to withdraw his question and apologize. There were points where Senator Biden was going on at length about an issue that nobody else in the amongst the Democrats or the Republicans considered a major issue. And just that just amounted to a waste of time. After all, Scalia was ultimately confirmed 98 to nothing. But perhaps most surprising to me was a statement from Senator Biden publicly in the newspapers at the time, to the effect that he didn't think that Antonin Scalia was going to wind up being much more conservative than Warren Berger had been. And that was precisely opposite to the considered statements and sentiments that have been expressed by every single law professor quoted in the news media for the past 90 days. Everyone recognized that Antonin Scalia was going to be a more conservative member of the Supreme Court than Warren Berger had been. Berger, after all, having presided over Roe versus Wade and the Bakke affirmative action decision that we mentioned and others. So it just seemed that that Senator Biden's grasp on the substance had to be called into question, given that he didn't see Antonin Scalia as likely to be more conservative than Warren Berger.
You know, the Watergate era is looming large over our politics right now, as you mentioned, renewed interest in a new kind of church committee. You've written extensively about the Watergate era. You wrote an autobiography. You wrote a biography.
I'm not that old.
Mitchell. that said, I have sort of a strange question, which is, do you ever find when you're researching these books, and I'm thinking especially as you're writing about Justice Scalia in the same period or a period of his life that overlaps with the Watergate period and overlaps with periods of, you know, John Mitchell's life as well, do you ever learn things about other subjects you've covered? Just get new information while you're looking into something completely different.
This is sort of like back in the day when you used to go to use the microfilm machine to look at old newspapers in the library, and you're supposed to be looking up something on Watergate, but there are the movie listings and there's the sports pages and the comics.
Irresistible.
So yes, I'm not immune to the seductions of divergence and digression. I have never really stopped my research on Watergate. I published that book, The Strong Man, John Mitchell and the Secrets of Watergate, back in 2008. I remain very proud of it. It brought a lot of new documentary material to the table at the time. But just in June, when we marked the 50th anniversary of the Watergate arrests, June 17, 1972, I published a long essay for Real Clear Politics. Tom Bevin, in tweeting it out, said, "Get yourself a cup of coffee, and I mean a huge cup of coffee, and sit down with this James Rosen essay on Watergate." It was about 10,000 words long. You can find it on my Twitter feed at James Rosen TV or through Real Clear Politics. It was called Watergate at 50, Revelations from Newly Declassified Evidence. And I tried to catch the reader up with all that's been made public and all we've learned about Watergate and its true dimensions since 1974, since President Nixon resigned. So I try to keep a hand in the other subjects that I've tackled. But here, with the publication of Scalia Rise to Greatness, we are not, Emily, even allowed the smallest measure of celebration or jubilation, because volume two looms over me. And I don't know if I told you this earlier, but let's just say that Mrs. Rosen was less than pleased that the decision to extend this book into a second volume meant that the lease in our lives that Justice Scalia has enjoyed has now itself been extended for another 2 years.
Oh, man, that's fabulous. Another question I have is that we're talking the night or the day after Oscar night, and there was obviously the Martha Mitchell documentary nominated for one of the documentary categories. And I think it was for short documentary, something like that. And there was the Julia Roberts series that came out in the last couple of years where she's Martha Mitchell. And there has just been renewed interest, not just in John Mitchell, but in Martha Mitchell. So just, James, do you have any thoughts on this renewed focus on Martha Mitchell and any of the recent depictions of Martha Mitchell who's sort of being latched onto by Hollywood as maybe a feminine hero of the Watergate era?
Not for the first time. This goes in waves. For the longest time, Laura Dern's mom, Diane Ladd, had wanted to play Martha Mitchell in a movie, and supposedly she had reached a preliminary deal with Martin Scorsese to do that. I read in the New York Times that Sean Penn, who played John Mitchell to Julia Roberts as Martha Mitchell, had consulted my book, The Strong Man, John Mitchell and the Secrets of Watergate, to help prepare for the role. But it's clear, and I didn't really bother to watch. I watched the documentary. I tried to help the ladies who made the documentary. They made clear to me towards the end that they were going to take a very different view of Martha Mitchell than my book had done. I was then the first researcher to gain hold of the Mitchell's FBI files. Martha Mitchell was not a heroine. Martha Mitchell was a sick lady who had some mental health issues, and who on top of that had a very serious drinking problem, and who caused a lot of trouble, not only for her husband and President Nixon, but for her daughter and for a lot of people around them. When she finally got the opportunity to tell everything she knows about all the dirty business that she was warning about, that supposedly took place in front of her eyes in the Nixon years, she was placed under deposition for a Watergate civil suit in 1973. And the transcript of that, which I brought to the readers of The Strong Man, showed that she just rambled on for 150 pages without saying much of anything. I think, you know, I was denounced in Teen Vogue as sexist for those views of Martha Mitchell when this thing came out. And to me, what's really sexist is the idea that we should conceive of Martha Mitchell today, and we should accept that no one can play Martha Mitchell today except someone who looks like Julia Roberts. Martha Mitchell didn't look at all like Julia Roberts, right? And the decision to cast her, this much slimmer and more conventionally attractive younger woman, it was insulting to the legacy of Martha Mitchell. And I think the audience is more sophisticated than that, that they can accept somebody who's heavier, older, and looks a lot more like Martha Mitchell than Julia Roberts did. That struck me as sexist. So I would urge caution to anyone looking to these series or these movies for serious history. I've gotten to the point, Emily, where I don't watch them. I never watched Nixon Frost either. I would rather watch 2 hours of the actual Nixon Frost interviews. He's not spoken well of today, but Will Smith, when he played Muhammad Ali in 2000, there was nobody you could ask to look more like Muhammad Ali and get the movements down and everything than Will Smith. But even that, it was a lesser experience than watching 2 hours of the lamest Muhammad Ali fight you could choose. So stick with the real thing, I say.
James Rosen, where and when can people pick up a copy of this fabulous new book, Scalia, Rise to Greatness, 1936 to 1986?
The when is right now. The where is Amazon, Books a Million, Barnes & Noble, or the publisher, Regnery.com. Anywhere you go in, walk into brick and mortar stores and buy books, you'll find it. It's where everybody sells books. It's called Scalia, Rise to Greatness. And as I say, this is the book that Scalia fans and all students of an accurate history of American law and society over the past 50 years have been waiting for.
Well, I hadn't realized that a second volume was forthcoming, so I'm eagerly looking forward to that now as well. James Rosen, thank you so much for your time today.
Emily, I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Of course. You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.